Welcome to the Alabama Literacy Network's podcast, which is designed to share information and best practices for literacy. We hope to bring a wide variety of resources together to help school leaders, teachers, and parents so that all children read at high levels. We believe that literacy is a fundamental right that is tied to so many positive outcomes that we want for all citizens. This podcast was brought to you by the Alabama Science of Reading Facebook group. If you haven't joined already, join for free today. With free professional learning and resources, you're sure to learn more about implementing the science of reading. I'm your host, Shelley Bell Smith. Today, we will be talking to Dale Chu. Dale is currently an independent consultant on education programs and policy. His experience includes senior positions at the Indiana and Florida Departments of Education. During his service in Indiana, Dale helped develop and implement all of the state's key education reform initiatives, ranging from educator effectiveness and school district accountability to collective bargaining and school choice. Dale's career includes two decades of work in pre-K through 12, serving as a teacher, lead teacher, assistant principal, principal, and consultant in both rural and urban districts. He began his career in education as a Teach for America Corps member in San Benito, Texas, located in the Rio Grande Valley along the U.S.-Mexico border. During his second year of teaching, Dale was recognized as the district's Teacher of the Year. He later became the founding principal at a high-performing urban charter school. In 3 years, Dale took the school from a 26% to a 96% pass rate, as measured by the state's assessment. His school was recognized for achieving the highest African-American student performance scores in the state. Dale is a graduate of Cornell University and earned a master's degree in administration and policy analysis from Stanford University. He is fluent in Mandarin Chinese and Spanish and resides in Denver, Colorado with his wife and daughter. Welcome, Dale. I'm so excited to have you here today.
I am so delighted to be here, Shelley. Thank you so much for having me.
So I would love to learn more about how you became involved in education and literacy, especially after just sharing that very impressive biography.
Yeah. So, I mean, I come to this, you know, come to the work of education and improving literacy as a former educator, teacher, and principal, and more recently now as a parent of a third grader, and being able to see this issue of literacy from multiple angles now. And I don't think it's until you're a parent that you really, really begin to listen and appreciate how important it is that our kids get off to a strong start when it comes to reading. I guess I would say, you know, when it comes to literacy, I feel like, think about how I was a principal, not to date myself, but, you know, it was, you know, this was sort of back in the early aughts. And I kind of feel like when I think about the energy and enthusiasm around science of reading today, I kind of feel like we were doing the science of reading before it was cool again. So back then, you know, I remember being a principal, Shelley, and I remember learning about Project Follow Through and sort of the research that was done there and sort of what that showed and just sort of how that sort of underscored for me, just, you know, how much we do actually know in terms of teaching kids how to read. And like, unlike so many of the areas within education policy that are always litigated and relitigated, I might argue that when it comes to early literacy, it might be one of the few areas within education policy that has something close to settled science, for lack of a better description.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And that's possibly the most exciting thing about what we've learned and are beginning to implement is, you know, this is the science and it's hard to argue with it.
Absolutely.
So you've been successful in improving what some people might view as difficult to improve schools. What do you think the key was to your success?
Yeah, a few things, Shelley. I would say one, you just have to be an unapologetic focus on students, right? That's often, you know, we say that a lot, keep the focus on kids, right? But moving beyond sort of the tension we give it with words, I mean, to me, like that means, among other things, being comfortable with some measure of controversy. So what I said earlier in terms of Project Follow Through and some of the work at the school that I led, we used direct instruction to support our kids. I mean, one of the programs is very scripted, right? And when we first started off, there were some folks who were not happy with that. They didn't feel like it was rewarding to them as an educator, as a professional, to use a scripted curriculum, but my perspective is always like, this is about whether the kids learn or not, whether less about whether the adults are comfortable with it. That's just one example, but you can sort of look at this across the board. To me, that's what the focus on students means. I also feel like sort of a corollary to that is just establishing within a school, at least, a culture of excellence to where everyone, especially when it comes to literacy, feels ownership over making sure every kid learns to read. It's not just the ELA teacher who's responsible for that. Like anyone who's touching the student, the cafeteria worker, the crossing guard, we're all responsible at some level contributing to that piece. And then I would say, I mean, it goes without saying, but it's worth underscoring, is great teachers. You have to have great teachers in schools. You can have the best facilities. You can have great technology. You can have best curriculum in terms of alignment with science of reading, but it doesn't come together without great, great teachers.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And as principals, we know how hard that job is. And, you know, supporting great teachers and doing that work is so important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As a writer, one of the things that you monitor and write about is the status of education nationwide, specifically kind of this fight between whole language and the evidence that we refer to as the science of reading. What are your thoughts on where we are as a country with issue?
Wow, I have so many thoughts, many thoughts on this issue, Shelley. I mean, I guess high level, I would say as a country, we've been at this for a while. I wrote a primer on this last year for National Review, where really, if you sort of try to look back, we've been at this or some iteration of this since the founding of the Republic. I mean, this debate about how best teach kids how to read. So there's that. But, you know, sort of fast forwarding to what we have right now in terms of the enthusiasm and momentum, it won't surprise you to hear I'm very encouraged by it. I think it's great to see. I just think we're going to need to be careful not to overstep. And what I mean by that is, for instance, I think you're beginning to see, for instance, some calls from some folks, like to, for instance, like professors of education who support whole language and balanced literacy, to just eject them from schools of education. I feel like that's a step too far, right? It becomes fraught when you get to that position. I think there's a big difference between saying, listen, you know, here's how we're going to teach kids how to read in this state, in this district, in this school, and then we're going to make sure we align everything, funding, policies, curriculum around this particular approach. There's a difference between that and then saying we're going to shut down debate completely. And I think it doesn't just go for the science of reading, but certainly it comes to the science of reading. But if we're going to be successful by making sure the science really is implemented as much as possible, it has to be about persuasion. It has to be about seeking converts to the science of reading. It cannot be about hunting heretics. And I get it. I understand sort of the zest, like you feel the momentum, like, yes, we're right, we're right, we're right. But those tables can turn very quickly. We've seen this happened with previous education policy, education improvement initiatives, and certainly would not want to see that happen to something as important as making sure all of our students learn how to read.
Yeah, there's so much to unravel in what you just said, and really respecting people and where they are in this journey to understanding the science and not persecuting people for not being as far along as perhaps other people. And then also, we are all learning. And so, yeah, don't never take for granted that you know exactly what is the truth, because we may discover something even further down the line that not proves us wrong, but makes us think differently about what we've been doing.
Yeah, I mean, I've been at this now, Shelley, for almost 30 years in education, right? I've met and worked with some great educators, not so great educators. But I've never met one that said, you know what, I'm going to wake up today, I want to make sure my kids don't know how to read. Like, everyone wants their kids to read. And so it doesn't behoove anyone to make people look bad in this. Like, you know, and when it comes to whole language and balanced literacy, there are a whole lot of actors in terms of schools of education and publishers and so forth that were complicit in this. And for a lot of folks, they came in, you know, they wanted to make a difference for kids. And there is something sort of initially alluring, compelling about what balanced literacy and whole language often talks about. And so, okay, we've learned. Let's do what's best for kids with that now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were talking about this history. And one of the things that really amuses me in one of the articles that you wrote was the fact about Horace Mann, who's, you know, considered the father of education, and he wrote kind of, he was really writing this whole language, like, don't focus too much on these kind of skeleton, scary shapes and letters. And so this does go back much further than most of us remember. And I remember being in school. I mean, I remember being explicitly taught phonics, and then later on, the phonics wars that most of us know about. But really, like what you were saying, this has been going on for a long period of time, and it's not going to be erased or transformed overnight.
Yeah, what you say there, Shelley, makes me think about a quote from Timothy Shanahan, you know, really esteemed literacy researcher who was involved in the National Reading Panel, among other key efforts around this. And I'm going to probably paraphrase and maybe butcher it, but he said something to the effect once of the problem when it comes to teaching kids how to read isn't that we don't have stuff that works or doesn't work. And the problem is that everything works in some level, right? So you have those numbers from like 40% of kids will learn to read no matter what you do. So even if you think that letters are like these skeleton, you know, apparitions, ghouls that Horace Mann's talking about, and you don't want to do that, and you want to take some like whole language or other approach, that won't work. For some kids will get through osmosis and some other things. And the people who do that will say, see, it does work. And that I think compounds the challenge we have with this particular issue. But I think what's great about some of what's happened in recent years in terms of states advancing legislation around the science of reading, that more folks are coming to recognize, okay, well, 40% is one thing, but there's still another 60% of kids that's not going to work for. And too often, those are the kids that are most often marginalized in our country. And it is a disservice to those communities and to those children if we aren't following the best science in terms of making sure those kids are well prepared.
I couldn't agree more. So you've written about this legislation that's been introduced across the country and what works to improve literacy. What can you tell us about the legislation and the aspects that do work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of it, a number of the states, it's fairly new, right? It's recent, last couple of years. So the jury is still out in terms of on that at high level. But at the same time, I think if you look at the states that have been the longest at it, you know, you think about Florida, if you want Mississippi, I think there are some encouraging lessons there. At least there's a suggestion of what might be the best approach. And it seems like with both of those states, taking a comprehensive one is the way to go. So that means first and foremost, making sure that teachers are trained in the science of reading, right? That's critical. You have to have, and that means, you know, pre-service training, job-embedded PD, right? Coaching, all of that in terms of the training on the science of reading. You have to make sure that there's early screening and intervention for the youngest kids, right? It's really hard to catch up kids when they're falling behind. Heck, I mean, I've often made the argument that if you can't get them to read by the end of third grade, that's the ball game. I mean, no one really wants to say that, but so important in terms of our youngest kids. The curriculum has to be phonics-based, right? And we have to make sure that families are included every step of the way. There has to be some measure of accountability. And when I say accountability, when it comes to literacy, I mean retention, right? And this is not a topic without controversy within the literacy space. But all of those things, I think, are the recipe in terms of success, in terms of at least legislation. And like any recipe, if you tinker too much with one or more of those ingredients, you might not get the results that you're after.
Oh, that's so true. I'm thinking about some of the recipes that I make just off the top of my head. And then I realize much later, wow, you forgot three ingredients. And it shows up in the finished product. And so in Alabama, of course, we have copied Mississippi in large part with their kind of comprehensive approach. And the retention obviously is a hot debate. And, you know, what I tell people all the time is no one's for retention. No one wants to, at the end of third grade, not have a student go to fourth. But I think one of your articles really, you know, looked at the data of long-term, do students who, you know, do another year of intensive work do better in the long run versus students who are just passed on. And so, you know, I think that your term, some form of accountability, is exactly what that's about.
Yeah, and the topic with retention is, I think too often the argument in terms of retention is it's framed as a binary, right? The choice is social promotion or use one test to promote or retain the kid. And like it, anyone who's been an educator knows it's not a two buttons. It's, if anything, it's a dial. And right. that where you set that dial depends on the individual child, right? So, you know, like Tennessee has gotten a lot of flack this last year around their policy. But when you really look at how things shook out, yes, there are a large number of kids that not pass tests they're used. But in terms of how the kids are actually retained through the conversation, the mechanisms, all these kind of things, it was only a small sliver. I'm not saying that, you know, Tennessee or any other state particular legislation around retention is perfect, but I do think there has to be this recognition that you want to use those data points, but at the same time, we need to really understand the particular child. Why is it that he or she did not pass the reading test? You know, what are some of the other measures and indicators teachers been looking at? What are the parents seeing? You know, all of those things have to, you know, lead to an informed decision. And when we stay at this, it's either this or this, and I support either this or this, that doesn't advance the conversation. We get stuck sort of in a cul-de-sac when we get there. So
absolutely. Another topic that you've written a lot about is the pandemic and the impact it has had on students academically. Can you share anything on this front? Because this is something that we're continuing to understand. You know, what are those long-term impacts?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we're still not really going to fully appreciate those full-term impacts. And we're still relatively soon, you know, early days out of the pandemic. So I'm not sure we fully comprehend that yet. I mean, certainly when you look at all the various numbers, the data, you know, that we haven't seen these types of drops ever. On the one hand, it's not surprising, right? You know, I guess I would say this, you know, there have been some studies that have sort of come out. One that really caught my eye was a few months ago, the National Bureau of Economic Research put out a paper. One of the co-authors was Emily Oster, and she's a professor at Brown. And what they did was they looked at, I think, about 20 states in terms of early data, in terms of sort of pre-pandemic and sort of like post-pandemic, to sort of, you know, sort of gauge the extent to which, you know, the extent to which they've gotten their kids back on track. And what was interesting, and they called this out in the paper, it's not to say this is a dispositive finding, but they felt like it was really interesting, was that in terms of that sample size of 20-some states, the two states that made the closest to the fullest recovery from pandemic learning losses were the two states that were the earliest adopters of science and reading legislation. So Mississippi in 2013, South Carolina in 2014, within that subset of 20 states, those were the two that made the furthest progress. And it's not to say, you know, the authors say it's not, you can't say it's causal in terms of, oh, science and reading means fastest kind of recovery. However, I think this is the kind of thing that's going to be worth studying and looking at, you know, in the months and years ahead in terms of the extent to which schools and districts really are embracing and implementing the science of reading in their classrooms, to see how, you know, how well they're doing compared to, let's say, states that have not been as serious or not as coherent, for lack of a better description, in terms of doing that.
That's a great word for that. You are a fierce advocate for charter schools and a member of Colorado's Charter School Board. How are charter schools across the country embracing the science of reading?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fierce advocate for charter schools. I would say I'm a fiercer advocate for parents and families, right? So my interest in charter schools is just the idea that parents should have the options to decide what's best for their kids. And I think we're beginning to see that, you know, certainly coming out of the pandemic, more and more of kids in the country they're not, again, put in this binary of like traditional public schools versus charter or private. I think it's beginning to blur across the board. So I think that's really interesting. I think, you know, there was a study that Stanford put out, Credo study, a few months ago that looked at the efficacy of charter schools, to your question, Shelley, and just some of the progress they were able to attain in comparison to traditional public schools was pretty impressive. I will say, you know, anecdotally, in terms of speaking with leaders of some of these charter management organizations, a lot of them have looked at their performance results, which also dropped, right? Just, I mean, there's really no difference between charters and any kind of, they just dropped, right? Because of the pandemic. And then, you know, when kids don't go to school, that tends to happen. But what's been really encouraging those conversations I've had is a number of them saying, hey, listen, we need to really look at how we're approaching literacy. And that often means, how can we better apply what we know for the science of reading in terms of our training of teachers, in terms of the curriculum, in terms of how we provide interventions, how we work with our families. And it's great. And I've heard these conversations too among traditional district leaders as well, but it's great. It's great to hear that. And it makes me feel like hopefully we can turn a corner here.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to characterize your interest in charter schools as anything other than just an interest in helping students. And I think that that's where charter schools began, was offering options for students and families.
Yeah.
So I really like reading what you write about the politics that are surrounding education. What are some of the trends that we should be aware of that may impact literacy?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, it's a great question, Shelley. To me, my response is a question that sort of gets at it, which is who's, for lack of a better term, leading the parade on literacy, right? And so certainly dyslexia parents, I think, have been a huge genesis and catalyst of this momentum, which I think is fantastic, the fact that it's been very grassroots in that sense. But what's been interesting is now you see organizations such as notably Moms for Liberty embracing the science of reading. And within this hyper-polarized political context we have now, it's definitely created some tensions, right? And I should say, even setting aside Moms for Liberty and some of these groups for a second, I mean, just the constituency that supports the science of reading is not, I mean, it's a really interesting constituency. It doesn't cut across sort of traditional lines as you might have thought of the education battles being, let's say, a decade ago. And in my mind, like when you know, it's just following some of these conversations where you have these huge proponents of the science of reading, but they do not abide Moms for Liberty supporting it as well. You know, I don't necessarily come down on one side or the other, but my philosophy is, listen, like there's that quote about, you know, being able to get far if you don't care who gets the credit. And ultimately, this is about what's best for students. Now, I also understand that, again, within our politics and the hyper-polarized culture and this mix of the culture wars and race and all these kind of things, it's not that cut and dry. This is another obstacle that is going to face science of reading. Because like, if you're a big supporter of the science of reading, and then now there's people who you don't agree with, maybe you don't like, maybe for people that you find abhorrent that also support your position, what does that mean? And this is not unique to the science of reading, but this is definitely something that we're seeing within the politics of literacy. And it's unclear to me at this point how that will shake out. If this momentum around the science of reading fizzles out, let's say in a few years, I would not be surprised if this particular factor is a big contributing one.
That's very interesting and also perhaps very concerning.
Yeah, it's both.
So you work with the Fordham Foundation. What can you tell us about the work of the foundation and how it supports excellence in education across the country?
Yeah, so I get the chance, you know, among many hats that I wear, is being able to write for Fordham. And they're often characterized as a right or center-right think tank. They're based in Washington, D.C., but they also have an organization that foundation works in Ohio that specifically works on authorizing charters there. Again, so I have sort of like a more narrow line of sight into Fordham, but what I've always really appreciated about them, and when I say them specifically, Mike Petrilli, who's the president of the Fordham Institute, is his openness to ideas. He's not an ideologue, and he welcomes differing opinions. Kind of feel like, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, like the success of the science of reading needs to be about seeking converts. It needs to be about persuasion. Like that's definitely a key orientation on Fordham. Like when I'm writing a post or Mike, whoever's writing a post, ideas, we're trying to persuade you. We might not persuade you, but we're not like bashing you over the head by saying like you're wrong or you're a bad person because you don't agree. And there's unfortunately, there's too much of that dominating our discourse today.
Yeah. So if people want to know more about your work, where can they go to find out more?
Yeah, well, I think you sort of preempted me on this one, Sean, because you talked about the very top of our conversation about how you followed me on Twitter. So I'm on Twitter. Actually, I don't know if I can call it Twitter. Is it the social media platform?
Now it's X.
Yeah.
Now it's X, which is bizarre because it still needs to be Twitter in my head. But I think how I started learning about your work. And then you certainly write blogs for Fordham that are really, really interesting encourage people, you know, to read. And I think for me, part of the appeal of reading something outside my state is to just see, you know, what is the rest of the country doing? And, you know, what does it look like beyond Alabama?
Yeah, and that's great, Shelley. I mean, Alabama is so lucky to have you, to have that perspective. You can't just be sort of in your own silo. I mean, yes, every state has their unique circumstances, their unique context. You can't minimize that. But at the same time, when we talk about the science of reading, there are a lot of states that have covered some of these grounds, the same ground. They've run into the same obstacles. And like now with a lot of states that are fresh to this, I think there's an opportunity to avoid some of the things that other states bumped into. And the extent to which they can do that would depend on sort of looking nationally and learning from other states. And so, you know, hats off to you, Shelley, for helping to lead the charge on that front in Alabama.
I don't know how effective I am at it, but I do love learning, and this is a great way for me to learn more. Dale, I want to thank you so much for being with me today. I appreciate
you
taking time, and you know, I look really forward to just continuing to follow you and read your work.
Thank you so much, Shelley. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Join us again for the next episode of the Alabama Literacy Network.